very much. I mean, you've made a quite a direct link between the existing political scene, as you call it, the environment, and perhaps not necessarily the protections in law, but certainly the application of what exists. And so it's not in the abstract. So I think I will throw the floor open and ask to come up to the mic if you have questions for Samina or Lamia. Yes, please, absolutely. As you were referred to a few times in the two presentations.
Thank you. Thank you for both presentations, and thank you, Lamia, for the second and very brave and strong words that you said. You seemed to ask for an invitation to talk about reservations, and I wanted to give you that invitation. I also agree that the question of reservations is highly relevant to the question also of many human rights issues in the Middle East, but also of the religious minority context, because once people interpret and understand and open these kind of obstacles or limitations on rights that are presented domestically, then they too can open the political space in the context that they live in. So I just wanted to invite you to talk about reservations and the relevance.
Thank you very much. It's actually a very animated and wide subject. But, of course, the reservations is a way of, is a right to the country to, or to the party to a treaty to express its will that it's going to abide by the treaty in itself, in its integrity, but with the exemption of some of the clauses in that treaty. But in human rights treaties, there is now a very big debate on whether this is possible, whether making reservations on human rights treaties is possible, because many of these clauses or rights that derive from these treaties have become jus cogens. You cannot just You cannot just breach these obligations, or maybe to make a kind of action which is not in line with these obligations. And on the other hand, as I mentioned, many of these clauses have also become customary international law. So whether the state adheres to these treaty or does not adhere, it doesn't matter. It has become an obligation, and an international obligation that the state has to abide by. In human rights treaties, of course, some of the Islamic countries and most of the Islamic countries have introduced reservations of a general term, and I don't have the exact, because it's a cliche that they use in each and every treaty, that say the meaning of it, that we are going to abide by the whole treaty except these clauses which are in contradiction with the Islamic law. What does that mean? It's very general, and of course it can, I mean, of course it takes us to another level of problems, because the Islamic, what is the Islamic law? it's subject to many interpretations, and I mean, this is a very wide, also another very wide debate and a very big problem. But in this regard, you cannot just say that I will not abide by the clubi if it's against my Islamic law obligations. This is not possible because it can void the whole treaty from its content and the whole obligation from its content. So at this stage, it's, I don't think that it's permissible under the state of law of today to make reservations on human rights treaties.
Can I just, following from that, I noticed the declaration, the Cairo Declaration of Islamic Rights, actually picks up on most of the universal rights. I don't think religion is specified, however, but Article 25, the very last one, says exactly what you said, will abide by all of that if, as long as it's in conformity with Islamic law. You know, what does it mean? But can I ask you for Egypt? I mean, there is a sizable Copt, because they recognize themselves as a minority, even though they are very much citizens of the land, and there may be some...
A huge minority, yeah.
But I don't know if they use themselves. We use the word minority if they use it themselves. But in any case, in terms of the discussions going on now with the Constitution, the application of law, what implications, what you've just said, are there for the Coptic community?
It's a very easy question. well, and it belongs to tomorrow's topic, but it's all right, it's generally. Generally, and I think the Coptic community now is in fear of what's happening on the in the political arena, and more and more infiltration of religion in legal documents, in all aspects of life. Of course, when I say religious infiltration, it's Islamic religious infiltration, of course. But there has been the so-called constitution, which, you know, is has been adopted, is in its Article 2 refers to the Sharia as the principal source of legislation, and this is not new. It comes from the previous constitutions, and this is of course another product of, you know, trading favors between the ruler and some factions in society. But anyway, it's this Article 2 witnessed some addition. In my view, many people celebrated this addition, and they said that they thought that the Coptic community should be very happy with the addition. I'm going to say, I was not at all, because I looked at it from a different perspective. And this is about adding a phrase saying, and for religious factions, different religious factions, they will have the right to apply their own laws in family matters and so on and so forth. This, of course, I mean, it adds to the problem, it doesn't solve it, because you add another element of religious infiltration, but not Islamic, but for other faiths, and it produces the same effect. While, for instance, this is in application to this rule, In the old constitution, which was of a general, this article was of a general nature, the Coptic communities and Christian communities were allowed, for instance, to divorce when the husbands and wives, Melah or type, the faction that they belong to are not the same. So Heder applies the Sharia law. The Egyptian law states that. Okay, this is it has been from since the 20s like this. Of course, it is not the most favorable article in for religious minorities to preserve their rights, but it gives them some opportunity and some window to have some way out for divorce matters. And now, of course, with this clause, which the church was very, very much in favor, of course, they are now in a very difficult position. So, you know, things are very complex, and you cannot see one direction or one track of the issue. There are many, many complexities involved. So, yes, of course, they are now, in fear, but this is, I don't think it's justifiable, because what the Egyptians, all of the Egyptians, are now asking for freedom, and this is the only way to get out of this difficult situation.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Ojo Madueke from Nigeria. Lamia, this is a question for you. You said the Arab Spring is still unfolding. My question is, there is a perception that under dictatorships in the Middle East, religious minorities were more secure, were better protected, and their rights were more respected. What is it in the majoritarian impulse of the Arab Spring that is endangering religious minorities in the Middle East, particularly of the Christian extraction? That's what. Second question is, since the Middle East has the honor of being the birthplace of two of the historical religions, Islam and Christianity. Well, Judaism, I know why I'm mentioning the other two. Judaism is one of them. But in terms of post 9/11 confrontation, there is a perception of a collision, a clash between the witness of these two, although the Christians may not accept that. My country, of course, Nigeria, is the largest country with 50% membership of, I mean, adherence of this. Is there a sense of responsibility by the birthplace of these two religions to create a template for global peace?
Ambassador. Well, two very very big questions, but I'll try my best to answer. Of course, you cannot, I mean, this is an argument which is all the time mentioned during the old regimes the previous regime. In Egypt, in Tunisia, minorities were better protected. And this, unfortunately, is advocated also by the church itself, you know, at the official level of the church. And this is, of course, explains why the church did not participate or allow its subjects or to its followers to participate in the revolution from the beginning. But fortunately, the people did not listen to that. And they, Al-Azhar as well. Al-Azhar said, I'm not going to be part of this. So, I mean, both institutions were against any change, because I don't know why, really. I wouldn't like to think why. But anyway, it's an argument that has been all the time brought out.
Is it true?
I don't think it's true at all, because what caused the Arab Spring, I mean, the Arab Spring is a revolution. It's a revolution against tyranny. What caused the very difficult, and of course, because people live very difficult conditions in a country like Egypt of 90 million people, 40% under the line of poverty, this is, I mean, an outrageous number of people living in extremely difficult situation. Who is responsible for that? Don't tell me, the people themselves, of course. So, I mean, what caused this situation is whatever regime was ruling the country. I mean, it's very obvious, or who else? And as I mentioned earlier, I didn't go into details, but really, I mean, during the Arab Spring, and especially in the very beginning, everything looked so, promising and so full of hope, that many facts were revealed. And some of these facts were really very, very significant and rather, you know, astonishing to see that it is the Minister of Interior himself who participated in organizing some of the, the violence committed against Christians in Egypt. This is really, I mean, outrageous to think about, but it happened, and this is obviously because they wanted to portray themselves as the protectors of faith. They wanted to justify their presence in power. So this is, when we know that, it's difficult to suggest or to argue that the minorities were better protected under these regimes. Tyranny has produced this situation, and nobody else should be accountable. As for your second question,
special responsibility of the Middle East being the birthplace of major religions to
of course, but leave the Middle East, live in peace, and decide for itself for once, and you will see a very different world.
Thank you. There's a question in the back. Oh my God.
I'm sorry, Sabina. I've actually got another question for Lamia.
Good.
I'm sorry.
You know, that's good.
This may be a very difficult and question to answer, but I want to ask quite directly how you see the differences with religious freedoms between Mubarak's Egypt and with the Egypt that we now have after the Arab Spring. There, please. Thank you.
Well, you want me to be frank, and I will be frank. I don't think there has been change in the regime until now. I think that the regime exists full-fledged with all its security apparatus, with all, and with the same way of dealing with issues. The same approach is repeated again. I'm not going to go into details, but it's a reality that we're living. But on the other side, I'm not dealing or seeing the Arab Spring as a one-time event that is finished and then we're now, post-Arab Spring. No. To say that is completely, not seeing the reality and the truth of the situation. It is an ongoing process that is continuing, and every day we see, you know, every day people learn a new thing in our part of the world. Every day, I really mean it. And it's always on the crescendo side. It's not, it doesn't go back, and it doesn't stay as it is. Every day there is a new technique that people learn, a new way of expressing themselves. And this is what gives us a lot of hope for the future.
Oh, my gosh. All right, you.
Hi there, my name is Haley Donnell. I'm a McGill student, obviously here at McGill. I'm a theology student, and I wanted to thank all three of you for sharing your time and your insights with us. I have two questions that aren't really related, but I'll ask them both anyway. The first is more for the diplomats. When you're on your missions, how do you sort of, for yourselves personally, how do you represent your country if it has policies that you don't necessarily agree with, either on a personal level or from a faith background? And then the other question is really for all three of you, and we've been talking a lot today about how the state protects minorities and their human rights to exist and freedom of religion and everything, but how does the state then react in terms of policy when those religious minorities or religious groups are betraying other people's human rights? Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't get the last bit.
Yeah.
Religious minority is impeding on the rights of another minority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does the state react?
Mm. Maybe this is for you. Well, the first question, of course, is one of the most controversial questions. Ambassador Allen, would you like to answer this?
I live in a simpler place than you do.
It's difficult. Of course, I expressed today my opinions because I'm not talking as a in my official capacity, of course. Otherwise, it would have been a very, very boring intervention. I can assure you. I know, and... But of course, you know, there is a limit to what you can tolerate as a diplomat and as a as somebody who has his personal views and the position that you are advocating and representing. Of course, there are some limits to that. I think the diplomat has to be, in a way, of course, faithful to his beliefs. At the same time, it doesn't have to be, you know, a show of, I don't know how to say that. But in any case, there should be a line. It's a very fine line, but a good diplomat would know where to stop, where to resign, where to continue, where to support. Yeah.
It's usually a question of conscience.
Yes.
Let's go. I see from way back. You put your hand up a long time ago.
Did you want me to answer that?
I'm sorry. The second question, you wanted to say something. Yes, indeed.
Which is about
minorities competing on other minorities.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Asif. Can you wait till? I think I'm glad you asked that question in terms of, and that's more relevant to a place like Australia, but I think other places as well. What we have noticed is, at least in the research that we have done, is that depending upon the issues that minorities raise, they can in fact undermine other minorities. And I didn't want to get a sort of beating from the chair to say that I was going over time, otherwise I would have built on that. In case of Afghanistan issue, the asylum seekers who are coming from Hazara into Australia, one question that started emerging was that Pashtun migrants who were in Australia for a long time before that, and they felt that Hazaras who were coming, they were using, from their perspective, the language of sectarian violence. and that Hazara are the persecuted minority, and that's why they should be given the right to come into Australia. So there was a sense that Pashtuns were being portrayed in a negative light, and that it wasn't really the true reflection of what was happening. Hazaras were obviously creating their own narrative, and they're still doing that. So that has created some tension, and it's interesting, and I can focus more on what's been happening in Australia. I think you see not just simply the communities, say Hazara community and the Pashtun, Afghan, and other Afghan communities competing for the space in which they can say that they're really making valid claims in terms of they need to be there, but even other community members who are not necessarily from these two communities, they have started taking positions. So you've got academics literally siding with one group or another. So how does the state negotiate between them? I think it depends on the level of the knowledge of the state. And when I say the state, it's really... I don't think it really represents a total reality when you say the knowledge of the state people within the state structures who have to deal with these issues. What I've noticed based on the research that I've been doing, that if the people who are given the responsibility of negotiating with this, between these competing claims, if they're not aware of really what the situation is on ground from where these people are coming, and they tend to make decisions or give in to decisions that I think probably they would not do if they were thinking of the situation in a different way. Now, for example, there was one claim, and I had to sort of put myself in a very difficult place in that. There was some claim suggested by Hazara that when they're stopped by the naval ships, the boats are coming in, they wanted to be interrogated not by people who spoke Persian, if they were from certain categories. So even though these people were not citizens, they were telling the Australian government that a certain kind of citizen should be allowed to interview them to decide whether they'd be coming in or not. Because the level of knowledge wasn't there, I think the decisions were being made in a way that could have been changed. So the level of knowledge of the people who constitute the state is very important. And it does make it difficult if it isn't enough knowledge, because then you end up making mistakes. The other bit that I want to quickly sort of talk about the research that one of my doctoral students has just finished is in terms of different religious communities. So there's Muslim communities and then the non-Muslim Christian communities. Their demands for, especially in case of Armenian, for what happened to be declared as a genocide on part of Australian government has created a sense of unease. Again, in that sense, the ability or inability of the state to fully appreciate what's happening on ground has sometimes led to decisions that I think could undermine. I think the state has a responsibility to learn about the diversity. And so in terms of the pluralism, it's not enough to say that we believe in a pluralist society. One needs to go beyond that to say, what does it really mean and where is the origin of that pluralism and what values really underpin that sense of pluralism, and then try and negotiate that. I don't think the state, and again, I'm limiting my answer to Australia, I don't think the state has always been able to get to that criteria that somebody like me would identify, but there are other states who may have done that. I'm not aware of that. So it's a long...
Thank you. Very interesting. Please.
I thank all three of you for giving us insights, and there's a lot to think about on the basis of what you said. My first question is a very brief one to Samina, and that's just about something that has already been said in terms of the minority perspective being interpolated in a certain way. Out there in Australia, and I would have liked to ask this question to a lot of other people as well, working on Muslim minorities in different parts of the world, how aware people are of aspects as the Ahmadis, for instance, having initiated the whole discourse of declaring everybody else in amongst the Muslim communities as non-Muslims. So that's something I would really like to know, because there's been such a long discussion about this, but that's something I'd like to know. Is that perception, is that aspect sort of part of the perception about how history sort of unfolded itself in terms of the Ahmadis? The second question is about Egypt. It's in relation to your statement about you know, like Islam as not being a religion that does not promote peace. You know, like, I mean, that's, you said something to that effect, and it's something I like to hear, but it also makes me apprehensive of you know, fora as these moving more towards the kind of interfaith dialogues that have been used in Pakistan, where, you know, like people start agreeing upon too many things, and the fear is that the differences are kind of marginalized, the real life differences are marginalized. So in terms of that, I really have to ask, which Islam are we really talking about? Because, you know, like, I know, coming from a Muslim country as an international student myself, that most Muslims, I would gather, want peace. But when we talk about Islam, which Islam are we talking about? Because there have been so many Islams, you know, like, I mean, right from the earliest times up to modern times. And was taught by some of my mentors that freedom in the religious sense doesn't really occur until there's freedom to allow everybody else to criticize us as well. You know, like, I mean, recognition of the other as the other is not as much a problem as you know, like impeding them to make a criticism. Like, the Islamic history that I'm aware of as a very humble student of the field is full of interpretations where, you know, like, many of the Quranic verses have been used to promote violence. We all talk about La Ikraha Fid Deen, which Professor Sharma was also very kind enough to quote. But I had made reference in one of my presentations earlier about the juristic discourse full of abrogations of this verse by many others. The question I want to ask in terms of Egypt is vis-a-vis a comparison with the Pakistani discourse, where, because of the situation we are in, where we're facing so much terrorism internally, there has been a lot of self-criticism as well, especially in the wake of media revolution that has taken place in Pakistan. We are already even talking, intellectuals are already even talking about the ideology of Pakistan, the raison d'etre for Pakistan in the first place. So there's a lot of self-criticism, which I think is very healthy. Is there any similar kind of self-criticism or you know, entertaining of critiques and criticism from the other side in Egypt? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Very briefly, quickly. I think in terms of Ahmadi, what we have to think about is that they're a subset of the migrants in Australia. And I think when I read the relationship, it's one of the migrant communities are in an unequal relationship with the majority community because of their size and the fact that they're new relatively in the system. Within that space, the Ahmadiyya community, I think for a long time, and I would say even now, have been in a relatively unequal relationship vis-a-vis the dominant Muslim community. But now, as the fissures are appearing within the Muslim community in Australia, with the Sunnis and the Shias saying that they're distinct from each other, I think Ahmadis are moving into a slightly different space. They have organized themselves much better. Sydney's their main center. But the struggle between Ahmadis as a counter to other Muslims hasn't really emerged in Australia in the way that you're talking about. It doesn't mean that they haven't tried to present themselves as the articulators of Islamic identity. And what I find often interesting is students enrolled in my classes, when they want to analyze Muslim point of view on certain issues, they would go to Ahmadi sites without realizing that they're actually the sites that the majority of the Muslim community would question as being representative of Muslim identity. But I think it's in that indirect way that they have tried to maybe present a different meaning of Muslims in Australia. Hasn't come to the point that you're saying, but the tensions are definitely there. And if anyone ever wants to, even now, try to pull you down or try to cause aspersions, all that they have to do is send an anonymous letter around the place, and these days maybe email saying that so-and-so is from Ahmadi sect, and suddenly the whole local community gets into this tension and tries to sort of shape where they go in relationship to that place. But I think briefly, it's there, the tension is there, it can be used, and it sometimes is being used, but not in the way that you have talked about. So.
Okay. I think we'll have the explanation now on the second part. One last question that will be you. But after Lamia replies.
Okay. I think you mentioned a very important point, which Islam? Because when we refer to the Middle East, it's not a geographically well-defined entity or area, but it goes from Morocco in the west until Iran, Pakistan in the east, and it's a very wide geographical surface, of course, which also has its bearings on the cultural and religious beliefs of the people living in there. So when we talk about Islam, for instance, in Egypt and the rights of women in Egypt, there is nothing to compare between the condition of women in Egypt and the condition of women in Saudi Arabia, and both are call themselves Islamic countries. I mean, I say call themselves because it's not a matter of, criticizing, but in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia, these are two countries where the state has a religion. So this is what I meant. But anyway, so it's a very wide range of interpretations. And of course, as you mentioned, there are different interpretations to the same rule in the Quran or in the Hadith. But interpretation isn't. I'm not an expert on interpretation, of course. But interpretation is an art in itself and a science in itself. So, of course, you know, it's from a very different perspective. Unfortunately, some interpretations were used in order to justify, the assertion of grip of power of the of the regime, or, for instance, more oppressive kind of regime. So, I mean, it was used. These different interpretations were used according to the political situation. But as of self-criticism, of course, this is a byproduct of an open and democratic system. It comes naturally. In Egypt today, we are, well, actually not today. As soon as the revolution took off, as soon in this same moment, you cannot imagine the number of artists, the number of writers, the number of spontaneous, art that is coming from the from Tahrir Square and elsewhere. Extremely rich and wide variety of arts, and of course, dealing with self-criticism, dealing with criticizing the ruler. Today in Egypt, try to say any statement, and you will see what will happen to you. So, Egyptians are known for their sense of humor, of course, and I think in this atmosphere, this sense of humor and self-criticism and flourished. So, we have self-criticism in Egypt today.
Okay. One last question.
To the extent that today people are criticizing matters that were not at all permissible to criticize, like religion, for instance. And this was totally taboo before. Today, it's open for discussion. So I think we're going on the right way.
Thank you, Professor Yasmin and Ambassador Mechemer, for your insights. What I have is really not a question. It's a very short comment. I'm going to keep it short. But to me, it's important because it really caps it shows very important points relevant to the course. Shall I repeat what I said?
No, that's okay.
Okay. Ambassador Mechemer, you mentioned the example where the interior minister of the regime was involved in one of the incidents, actually, where one of the Christian churches was blown up. And to me, this is an instance where it shows that the regime was actually trying to divide Muslims and Christians. It viewed the national unity of Egyptians as a threat to the regime, and that defined many of the actions that were taking place. Another instance is the second clause you mentioned in the Constitution that emphasized the role of religion for Muslims and Christians. It pleased the church. It pleased the Muslim religious authorities. It didn't please many of the people, Christians and Muslims. I mean, to me, those two incidents highlight the complexities of the issues of this course. That these are two instances that you could easily take at the simplistic level. You take them as religiously motivated. This is about religion. But in reality, we need a more nuanced analysis to see what's going on here. So that's the importance of this. And also, I go back to the first point of the regime trying to divide the play a game between Muslims and Christians. This reminded me of some of the statistics we saw this morning by Ambassador Grimm, that in one of his statistics he showed us that actions by the regime showed some favoritism by the regime to one sect over another. So I hope incidents like this can problematize such statistics. Yeah. I mean, you know, admittedly, I don't know what the dynamics that went into the statistics, but my point is we really should try to scratch the surface before making religion our only.
We'll take my last comments because I see Dan coming up with a very determined
way to go.
Sorry.
No. Well, I was just going to shift the mics. One of these isn't working.
Okay. That's why people were saying, apparently, I think this one isn't actually working.
It is coffee time.
So, many thanks to our panel. Thank you. Very rich discussion that provoked in terms of the conversation. We actually had a little bit more time to exchange, which was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.